Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Barbara Hand Clow, who we will be talking about her latest book, Revelations of the Aquarian Age. Barbara is an internationally acclaimed teacher, author, and Mayan calendar researcher. She has numerous books, including Revelations of the Ruby Crystal, The Palladian Agenda, Alchemy of the Nine Dimensions, Awakening the Planetary Mind, and The Mayan Code. I believe she was also the founder of Baring Company, and we just interviewed the author of White Spirit Animals, who is of the same company, and the author of that book expressed her gratitude for having a forward-thinking company like Baring Company to publish her book. So we appreciate that contribution as well. Welcome, Barbara. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Susan. Thanks for having me.
Well, this book is a fictional book, but it has a lot of very interesting components in it that speak to energetic shifts that are happening now and I guess have been happening for a while. And I guess we'll probably talk about that more than the exact plot of the book, because people really should read the book. We don't want to spoil their reading pleasure by giving everything in the book away. Is that fine with you?
And I completely agree. And also, you just have to experience fiction. That's for sure.
Right. Exactly. Well, I guess we can start off by having you tell the audience how you got into this line of work, consciousness, spiritual development, and what led you to the path to study these different energetic and interesting shifts that we've been going through.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, I've written many nonfiction books in healing and in astrology, as a matter of fact, also regarding just the issue of cycles. And so I was a mom and raised four kids until I was 40. And then I went to graduate school with Matthew Fox, who's a great spiritual teacher. And in this case, it was basically a Catholic institution. And mm-hmm. at that point, after working in being in graduate school for about a year, Matthew Fox was looking for somebody to take over Baring Company Publishing, which he had started actually in Santa Fe, New Mexico, about 5 years before that. So my mm-hmm. husband's a publisher, and I was all set to do acquisitions in this field because I have a fairly wide-ranging level of reading in this field. So my husband Jerry and I went to Santa Fe, and we ran Baring Company for 20 years. And then
Wonderful.
It was sold to Inner Traditions about in 2000, about 15, 16, 18 years ago. So that's my publishing background. And then in the middle of all that, I've been a writer all the way through. So I've written many, many nonfiction books. And then then 5 years ago, I switched to fiction, which has mm-hmm. been a big curiosity to a lot of people. Like, why would I switch to fiction after 40 years of being in nonfiction? And the mm-hmm. reason I went into fiction is because I was interested in having many, many different voices talking about the ideas that I'm fascinated with. I just reached the point where I just needed a broader field. So I decided to write the Revelations trilogy, and Revelations of the Aquarian Age is the second book in this trilogy. And it's focusing on development of the cycle of moving out of the age of Pisces, which is the age of organized religions, and into the Aquarian Age. And so that's what the trilogy is all about, and I'm right in the middle of it right now.
Well, you have one more book in the trilogy then?
Pardon? I have one more to come, yeah. And as a matter of fact,
right.
I'm working on it right now, yeah. Yeah,
right.
The plan was to cover 2011 through 2020 AD. And mm-hmm. the reason for that is, as an astrologer, I think that this particular 9-10 year period is the real vortex, the real turning point of the movement into Aquarius. And I decided to tackle it because when the ages shift, like, for example, 2,000 years ago, we went into the age of Pisces and left the age of Aries. And whenever the ages shift every 2,200 years, there's a tremendous breakdown of the themes of the old age, and there's a tremendous amount of chaos stress and difficulty as the new consciousness comes in. And so I started working on it in 2011, and by 2014 I could tell that I was on the right path, because at this point we're at a point of extreme instability and chaos right now, which is very, very hard for all of us to handle.
And that probably is true of any time between the shifts of the ages, would you say?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, you've heard that old saying, you know, that where they say, you know, it's going to be hard on your life if you're born into interesting times. And
right.
What they're actually referring to is the change of ages, because there's actually a huge tracking over a period of thousands of years of the change of these ages, which I've actually studied and followed myself. And at that point, when it really does really shift, as it is right now, it's just extremely difficult, very, very confusing.
So let's go back before Aries. I want to go back maybe. Is Taurus right before Aries?
Yes.
Age of Taurus?
Yes,
okay.
And one of the things that confuses people is that they go in reverse. You know, so here we're going into Aquarius, but we're coming out of Pisces, and then before Pisces is Aries, and then before Aries is Taurus. And the age of Taurus, which is 2 to 4,000 BC approximately, was an age of great stability. It's the time of the goddess culture. It's the time of the build-up of the Egyptian civilization, Sumerian civilization. So the age of Taurus was an age of stability. And we really haven't had a lot of stability since the age of Taurus, because the age of Aries, which is 2000 BC up to around 0 AD, is the age of war and aggression. And then the age of Pisces has been the age of organized religions. And then one of the things that happened was the warfare of the age of Aries kind of slipped into the age of Pisces for 2,000 years, and we've been dealing with wars for God. And it's been very, very hard on human cultures to have to deal with these kinds of archetypes.
Yeah, I never realized, you know, growing up in America, you really don't realize how war-torn the world is. I think Michener wrote a book on called Poland or about Poland, and throughout the entire book, it was the story of how they would build up things for 25 to 75 years, and then someone would come in and destroy everything. You know,
yeah, that's right.
Europe is just war-torn to such a degree. And of course, we don't really study European history, so we don't realize how serious the age of Pisces was with war.
Yeah, and that's a good point on your part, because you notice the novels are set, both of them, all three of them, are set in Roman Tuscany, and there's only a few visits to the United States. And I set the trilogy deliberately in Europe just because the Europeans tend to have so much more of a long historical perspective. And regarding being an American, if you don't have some kind of historical perspective, then all of this change is even harder to handle. I mean, right now it seems like we're going to be in chaos forever, doesn't it?
You know, we want that.
Yeah, I know, but it seems like
I think
like
we're going to be fine. Yeah, but no, I mean, absolutely. The mainstream media and there's all sorts of information wars going on, and all sorts of false flags, and you know, just incredible amount of things happening to disturb the peace.
And reality is fractious, which means fractured. One of my therapist friends recently said to me, commented that the world is broken. And so when you're at that point, it feels like everything is going to disappear and fall apart and deteriorate and go away. And yet it's not. It's what's happening is we're just in the middle of a process of change.
And I think what people have to understand is that in order for things to be rebuilt in a better fashion, they have to be torn down. So medicine has to be torn down, law has to be torn down, government, you know, the governing things need to be torn down, and corporations need to be torn down. So all of these things have to be torn down before they can be rebuilt in a more ethical and, you know, in a way that is better for the new age that we're entering.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah.
But then, you know, we have in medicine, you know, about all the holistic doctors that are getting murdered. You know,
oh, yeah.
There's real battlegrounds everywhere.
Oh, yeah, I agree. Especially, it's especially stressful in medicine because people need to take care of themselves, you know. And then it's also especially difficult for people when it's religion, because people depend mm-hmm. on religion so much. And yet here we are right in the middle of the breakdown of the old religions, and that's mainly the religions coming from Abraham. And all of them are going to break down and transform into something else. They won't go away, but they're going to transform.
So explain a little bit more about the religions of Abraham, because I don't think just everybody out in the audience knows what that is.
Mm-hmm. Well, the religions that come from Abraham are, first of all, Judaism, which is the first one, and then Christianity, mm-hmm. which is the second one, and then Islam, which is the third one. And all mm-hmm. three of these religions use the Hebrew Bible, that some people call the Hebrew Bible. Some people call it the Old Testament, but I prefer right. Hebrew Bible. And so all religions are coming from the Hebrew Bible and the beliefs of Abraham and the beliefs of the chosen people. And at this point, now after about 3,000 years, what's going to happen is those are going to break down and transform into something else. And I think we can see elements of where it's going in new consciousness and in New Age spirituality. Because if we go back before organized religion having so much control over people, a lot of people had different ways of having direct access to spiritual consciousness and to spiritual mm-hmm. realms. And so in my own work outside of the trilogy, I've been working all these years on direct access to spiritual realms. So the books are working to some extent with Gnosticism, because one of the movements 2,000 years ago that was advocating for direct access to spirit were the Gnostics. And so this book, the books are covering some of the different spiritual traditions from 2,000 years ago that got buried at the time, but are probably going to be coming forth in our time.
Yeah, years ago, probably about 10 years ago, I was guided to read Holy Blood, Holy Grail.
Mm-hmm.
And from that book, and this was way before the Dan Brown stuff, so
yeah.
In that book, I was guided to understand that a lot of the gifts of the Spirit and a lot of the gifts of the ability to directly access came through the genetics, and it was actually through the bloodline of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a very important book in my development, understanding that the bloodlines, which started in the house of David, really, and then went through, and it went, like, in your book, I didn't realize that it went so strongly into the American Indian. Mm-hmm. Do you want to explain a little bit about the bloodline and how that is so important for uniting the three religions that came out of Abraham?
Yeah, you're going right for the core, which is great.
I am.
Because in all three of them, I'm going right after the issue of the bloodline, because coming from Jesus and Mary Magdalene. Because I have experienced, actually had visionary states of seeing that we have crystalline content in our blood, and that at this point, 2,000 years after the arrival of Jesus on this planet and his relationship with Mary Magdalene, basically most all of us have contact with that level of spirituality through our blood. So mm-hmm. meanwhile, if we go back through history, once we get to like maybe 50 AD or 70 AD, then organized religion took over and they made Jesus into kind of a eunuch. First of all, the story was Jesus came from an immaculate conception, which is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And there's reasons for that that discussion happening, but basically what happened was Jesus was just made into an asexual kind of eunuch figure, and then that mm-hmm. became the prototype for the priesthood, especially in the Roman Catholic Church. And so what right. happened was half of the equation, which is the feminine and the mother and the daughter and the partnership, half of the equation was taken out of organized religion. And mm-hmm. unless that balancing between male and female comes back into organized religion, they're not going to survive, because it's making people crazy.
And they actually did worse than that. They wasn't there a time when Mary Magdalene was supposed to be a prostitute? I mean,
yeah,
it was
right.
It was really, women weren't just left out, they were actually demonized.
Yeah, and that's actually kind of ironic, because if you go back 2,000 years ago, there was the whole issue of women and men having sacred sex and having having a sexual bond that was considered to be divine and enabled mm-hmm. them to access spiritual consciousness just through their own sexuality. And so what was really being called a whore or prostitute was actually the whole idea of the feminine and sacred sex. And we can't function because our major access to higher consciousness and to divine fields of consciousness, a lot of our access is through sexuality. Almost right. anybody listening to this program who has lived a life for a while starts to realize that one of the easiest and most direct access to the divine is actually through their own sexuality. And
right.
The Aquarian Age is going to bring all this stuff out, because we can't function anymore biologically mm-hmm. by having these aspects of our physical experience just basically taken away from us.
And Mary Magdalene came out of the pagan religion and was a high priestess in that whole religion, and actually had to get permission from her goddess to marry Jesus. It was very mm-hmm. interesting.
Yeah.
So she really was coming out of that tradition.
Yeah, and there's really a lot of wonderful books. This is just one of many that's exploring the issue of who Mary Magdalene is. And then another
right.
thing that's going on in this trilogy is my characters are reading different people who are discussing these issues. So that mm-hmm. the book is kind of half fictional and half non-fictional in a way, because there's all this information in the books about how to get a hold of this information about Mary Magdalene, or the issue of Jesus mm-hmm. even possibly and the sacred bloodline actually being connected to Native Americans. Because what we're in the middle of right now, Susan, is just an explosion of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, it's happened so fast and it's so intense for people that their heads are spinning. In fact, people are accessing, from one point of view, too much information without thinking about all the connections and all the meaning within the information mm-hmm. that they're accessing. And so I switched to fiction partly to capture some of these mm-hmm. young people, especially, who are just overwhelmed by all this information, because we're living in such an awakening, of consciousness. I mean, it's just wonderful.
Just about a half an hour ago, I read Benjamin Fulford's latest report, and he says that the Templars were just invited back into the Vatican, like just now.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a reunification. Well, the split was on Friday the 13th, you know, when the Pope had the Templars murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people can look this up. But basically, the Templars were the original bankers and the original keepers of the mystery relics and the secrets mm-hmm. from the family of Christ. So
yeah,
there's
they were
a lot
the protectors
about
of
the Templars
bloodline.
In your book.
Yeah, they
yeah,
were
well, just today they were invited back into the Vatican. Isn't that amazing?
Well, it's amazing too, because another thing that a lot of people don't realize is that there's a whole bunch of modern Templars. There are Templar organizations, like I've taught in Templar temples in Europe,
mm-hmm.
But in the United States, all you get is the Masons. And then who the Masons are and who the Templar are, it's all very complicated with what these groups actually are. And they're not all good, but they're also not all bad. And
right.
as far as what the Vatican is doing about this, it's very difficult to tell what's going on, because, you know, from one point of view, we have a pope who is certainly a more favorable individual than the previous pope. But on the other mm-hmm. hand, after the last 2,000 years with the Roman Catholic Church, we all have to be deeply suspicious of what they're doing.
Right.
And I didn't read this latest posting by Benjamin Fulford, so I'll check it out.
It's a fascinating posting.
I bet it is, yeah.
It is. I believe that there's high-level negotiations going on between the Cabal, the Vatican, the Templars, the and there are other names with the Templars. You're right. It's more than just one organization. I don't remember them, but the Maltese Cross, I think, comes up. And but all of these organizations, including the Dragon families, are in negotiation for not just the, you know, access to all of the information, much of which is in the Vatican, but also access and power of the financial system. You know, Venezuela just brought out a new cryptocurrency, I think, in the last day or two. So there's huge shifts in power structure going back and forth, and kind of a compromise is occurring. Because the power structure is shifting significantly.
And I'd like to address that by making the comment that we're not looking for the religions and the financial institutions and all that to completely disappear and have something new come. What we're looking for is a transformation within those organizations themselves. And so that, you know, because we can't exist if everything is thrown away. So there is, I agree with you, there's a tendency within some of these significant organizations to be going through deep reflection and deep processes of change. And as the public, we don't hear very much about that. One of the reasons I've enjoyed writing this trilogy is it's given me the opportunity to investigate some of those shiftings within those organizations at a really deep level. And then in terms of publishing the trilogy, I can't really reveal everything that I'm finding out, but I can pretty much put most of it right out on the table.
Right. And, you know, this has been done for many, many years. When people really want to address something, like when Garth Nicholson wanted to address his four assassination attempts when he discovered the weaponized mycoplasma that was causing Gulf War and other problems, he didn't write it as anything but a fiction book. You know, it's like when you write fiction, there's a level of protection there.
Yeah, yeah. And so what I did was all of the background material, the events, the books that are referred to, all of that stuff is 100% accurate. But then there's things where things are going on, like under the Vatican. For example, some sexual rituals going on underneath the Vatican.
Right.
Now, in my case, I actually had direct references about that from people, but they're confidential. And what fiction has enabled me to do is a lot of people have talked to me confidentially over the years, especially having been a publisher for 20 years as well as a writer. And so fiction also enabled me to reveal information that I couldn't possibly publish in nonfiction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Mayan calendar, because, you know, I've had, is it Callahan? I've had him on the Temple of Health radio show. I've done extensive interviews with people all throughout this, mainly because it's very important understanding what's going on now. Would you like to talk a little bit about what the Mayan calendar means and what actually happened in either 2011 or 2012, depending on how you look at it?
Yeah, and you're referring to Dr. Carl Kaleman, who's a close colleague of mine.
I've had him on several times. Right?
Yeah, he's great. And what I did something different with the Mayan calendar. I did something that I haven't found anybody else who has actually done. I find that both Kaleman's date, which is October 2011, and then December 21st, 2012, I have found that both of those dates are relevant. And they're just covering slightly different fields of information. And so this fight that developed in 2012 was very destructive, and the media really frothed it up and tried to make the whole Mayan
calendar. That movie, 2012, that was something else.
Well, the media tried to make it all look very silly and all very meaningless, but what I did during 2012, well, first of all, the issue of 2011 would be the completion of time acceleration on some level. In other words, 2011 was the most time-accelerated year. And then since 2011, time is functioning in a different way. And I'd almost have to
leave
it up to
it's going a lot faster.
Yeah, they're going a lot faster, but also now what's happened, according to Kalaman, is that all nine levels of the Mayan calendar, nine timelines, are actually functioning as waves. And so he uses the term waves a lot. And so we're dealing with time that's functioning in a different way. And then when 2012 came along, that was the first year where time was functioning in a different way. And it was extremely chaotic and bizarre, and people were fighting and all that. And yet I find that both issues are extremely relevant, and also all kinds of amazing things did happen in 2012 that indicate a huge shift of our understanding of reality. For example, string theories, string physics was verified in 2012. And the verification of string, and this, by the way, this is covered more, this is more a subject in the trilogy, where one of the characters, Claudia Togliatti, is hooked on the Mayan calendar in 2012. And so she's constantly pointing out different things that happened in 2012. But the most significant one to me is actually the verification of string theory, because then that enables us to start to get in touch with many dimensions. And so there was a huge shift.
Reality is so important to understanding everything that's going on.
Yeah.
And string theory is one of your best ways to do that.
Yeah. And so what's enraging is there was a gigantic shift in 2012, but the media made it look like the whole thing was a joke. But, of course, that's what they always do.
That's their job, though. That's their job. Operation Mockingbird is to control the mainstream media and Facebook, Google, and Twitter, or anything else that's social media, and it's just very interesting what we're headed toward, which could be even more restrictive, or at least the plans for a more restricted society are there. Now, I don't know that it'll actually manifest, but there's a direction that we don't want to go in.
Well, I think if people are on social media 90% of the time, I think they've got to realize that they're going to be mind-controlled. You know, in other words, if you expose yourself to that level every day, day in and day out, you're being mind-controlled. And I'm waiting for the millennial generation to wake up and realize they're being mind-controlled. And I think they will.
Well, there's hope that they will.
Yeah.
But they need some leaders from within.
Oh,
and that's what we don't see.
Yeah.
But I, you know, the generation right before the millennials, they're the ones that want the truth, that can discern the truth really well, and so maybe the leaders will come out from them.
I think they're going to have to. In my case, of course, I'm a boomer, and I'm of the generation older than that. And as a teacher out there teaching classes as well as writing books, I ran into more and more people all the time, people who are the generation below me, who had actually read everything in my footnotes. That generation, they are deep researchers, and they are serious readers, and I think some major leaders are going to come out of their group.
Yeah.
I'm watching for them.
Right. Well, do you want to talk a little bit about some of the physical evidence that the Templars kept intact and the importance of that, and then probably why the Templars were attacked by the Vatican?
Well, the thread that I'm following in the trilogy is the issue of the Talpiot tomb in Jerusalem. The greatest physical evidence that we have of the actual existence of Jesus and his family and Mary Magdalene and all that has been discovered with a research on tombs that have been found in Jerusalem, called the Talpiot tombs. And this has been, there's been a big attempt to cover this up, but there's been a lot of publicity about it, and a lot of major people have gone into this issue, such as James Cameron, who did Avatar, and Simcha Jakubovici, who's a Israeli filmmaker. And so we have a lot of information at the physical level for an entirely different story regarding the life of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. So I covered that material very extensive in some of the scientific testing and all that. One of the characters in the book, Simon Appel, is a reporter for the New York Times and for some papers in Italy. And he is a researcher into the issue of the tombs in Jerusalem. And that's how that information comes into the trilogy. So that's part of the physical evidence. And then we have lots and lots of stories and everything about the Templars. And in my case, then what I did is I went into heavy-duty psychic research regarding what were the Templars actually protecting, which I think are the bones of Jesus and his family and Mary Magdalene that became relics mostly in medieval Europe. There's all this issue of all these reliquaries that have these bones in them. And I think that the Templar managed to protect those relics and to spread them around the world. But that, Susan, is fictional. That's speculation on my part. The issue of the tombs being scientifically verified is not a speculation. It's a fact.
Mm-hmm. Was the story about the one of the people handling the bones that was broken because of lawsuits, was that true?
I don't know what. I know what you're thinking of. What you're thinking of is the tomb of James, the brother of Jesus. And what they found in 2003, I think, is that the ossuary, which is the bone box of James, turned up through a collector in Jerusalem, and then when that box was shipped to Canada, to Toronto, to be on exhibit, the box was actually broken. But it wasn't the issue of the bones; it was the issue of the ossuary being broken. Unfortunately, the Israeli antiquities people, whenever they get an ossuary with bones in it, the first thing they do is take all the bones out of the box and put them into a great big pile where they're buried later on as sacred relics. And so the bones have pretty much been separated from the boxes. But in the Jesus family tomb, there is very, very advanced scientific testing was done on the patina of these ossuaries, and they actually were able to get bone fragments, and they were able to get enough material so that they could do DNA testing. And they actually have the DNA of Jesus.
That means they could clone him.
Yeah, and so there's a big cover-up on this one, because the problem is, you know, the fairy story has been that Jesus, you know, didn't have any brothers and sisters. He didn't have a family, the whole story about Jesus.
Right.
And the Jesus family tomb shows that the whole story of the life of Jesus is a complete fabrication.
Yeah.
And so the Jews are trying to cover it up. The Christians are trying to cover it up. There's less of a tendency, by the way, for the Muslims to cover this story up, because the Muslims and Islamic religion is actually pretty advanced in their understanding of who Jesus was. And their understanding of who Jesus was is closer to the real story back around 50 AD, as far as I'm concerned. And quite a few other people feel that way, too.
So, yeah, there's some real amazing stuff in the Quran, like that the asteroid belt is mostly water, you know, just the stuff that you would think, how in the heck did they know that, you know?
Yeah,
and I think you're right. I think that the way they describe Jesus is very close to the truth. And Moses is highly regarded in the Quran. So
that's right.
It is very interesting.
And so I'm after that one. I'm after that one because I think that one of the ways that all three religions could transform to another level would be if they could comb out the parts of their religion that are false, such as the false story of the life of Jesus, and if they could start to bring through a more correct and significant understanding of who this person was. And the interesting thing about that is part of the access to that is actually through the Quran. And so you can see how, if this can happen, which is the reason I'm writing about it, then the possibility of stopping wars for God is going to come into our reality. Because the arms manufacturers are going to be happy to keep this going as much as possible.
Yeah.
You know, but the people
are
the losers.
One of my good friends is Tricia McKinnon here in Atlanta. She wrote a great book on the Jesus, the story between about age 8 and then the beginning of his his, when he was working with the disciples and all the mystery schools. And I think if people understood that Jesus really worked hard to get where he was, get to ascension, and then even though he ascended, decided to come back down to finish his mission, I think people would really need to understand that he was a remarkable person, but yet came out of the Egyptian and the Druid and even the Indian traditions, the spiritual
traditions. And I really admire Tricia McCann's work. And so she endorsed Revelations of the Aquarian Age. It's the first endorsement.
Right.
Yeah, she really liked it. And she's been one of the people who has really opened the doorway up wide.
Yeah, she has. And she also has done work on the goddess, which is, of course, at this time incredibly important, as you know, because without balancing the masculine aggressive energy, we're never going to get into the, the principles of the Aquarian Age. We'll stay stuck in the Pisces Age. So
that's right. That's right.
Yeah. So you said in the book, and I just want to emphasize this, that if indeed the bones of the family of Jesus, which were, Jesus, Mary Magdalene, and was it some of the children, or what were the other things in the...
Yeah, one of the sons, Judas, and the brother, James, is very important because he ran the church after Jesus was gone. So the actual family tomb of Jesus has all of these, aspects of the family that are so important.
Now, they're in different stories, they say that Jesus may not have died on the cross, that he may have actually survived and, lived, gone to France with Mary Magdalene and then gone on to India. I was interviewing an author who wrote American Nation of the Goddess. I can't remember his name, but he's a great historian. And I said to him that I had some information that Jesus may have spent time in India after the crucifixion. And he actually said, he actually reported that there's things in India that would support that, writings of other people in India that would support that idea.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of sources and a couple of really good books about this issue. And I'm after that one more in book three. But I think that it's highly likely that Jesus lived until he was about 70 years old and was an important Eastern teacher. And if more and more people begin to consider an idea like that, then again, there's going to be less East-West tension, which is certainly the most important thing at this point, is to seek to bring down the tension between East and West.
Yeah. So what do you know about the children of Jesus? How many were there, and what happened to them?
I have to tell you that I just don't know very much about it. There's a possibility there were three of them. There's a number of different sources on this. But what I think personally is that I think it's highly likely that there were probably three children.
But I do too. And I think that the bloodline came through the third child.
Yeah,
because the other two didn't really, I mean, they had some children, but the bloodline did not continue, on.
Yeah, and I'm trying
through
to remember who wrote about that. It could have been Tricia, but it was certainly somebody wrote about that fairly extensively.
Yeah.
And if somebody has really gone into something extensively, I don't tend to do it myself because I'm trying to go after the stuff that hasn't been covered, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think I do think that it's absolutely impossible not to see that there's a bloodline.
And the bloodline, just to fill in the audience, the bloodline first went to the Moldavanian kings. I'm probably mispronouncing that.
Mm-hmm.
But the kings in the bloodline went into France and that area, and then it went over into England and the Druids and especially the Tudor court, and then came to America. A lot of the forefathers of America had the bloodline and were actually, I think there were Masons and other members of other secret societies in the development of the, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And then tell us about the Templar relationship to the American Indian, because I had not heard that before.
Yeah, this is really new stuff, and this is really hot. And this is the research.
There you go.
Yeah, I know. This is the research of William F. Mann, M-A-N-N.
Okay.
And William F. Mann, at this point, is the head of the Canadian Templar, the whole group. And he has written a couple of books on the issue of the Templars coming over to America to protect the bloodline. In other words, it's some of the early people who came to America. And this is even before Columbus. There's an issue of people coming over a couple hundred years before that. And then once they got over here, the Inquisition continued to chase them. And so the Templars protected them while they were in the eastern United States, and then they eventually made them their way all the way into into the Southwest. And this is the research of William F. Mann, and people should really consider getting a hold of this guy's books, because this is hot material. But because it's so complicated, some of it's based on the analysis of paintings that actually show maps of where the people went who were escaping the Inquisition. And because the material is so complicated, a lot of people shy away from it. But boy, this is a hot issue. And so what I do, the reason I enjoyed fiction is a couple of my characters get onto it. And then in my books, I have discussions between my characters of an issue like this. And the reason that I've enjoyed doing it this way is, like, one character is like an investigative reporter, and another one is just an avid reader, and another one is a theologian. And it's in their discussions between themselves that I'm able to really bring out how exciting this material is.
And one's a Jungian therapist. That was
So
interesting in all the past life stuff. That was
great. Lorenzo Giannini. And now he's an interesting character, because the way these characters came to me is in May of 2011, I was sitting in my writing office relaxing, and I had a tablet and a pen. And I got a vision of these characters, and I sat there for 3 hours with my pen, writing out their names, their family background, their ages, their careers, a full description of each one of the characters. And all of them came in except one, and the one that didn't come in at that time is Lorenzo Giannini, the Jungian analyst that you've noticed. And so one of the funny experiences with writing the first novel was that I got about a third of the way through it, and then I came to a point where I was stuck, and I didn't know which direction to go. And then suddenly it turns out that the character that was stuck was actually in analysis for 10 years with Lorenzo Giannini. So Lorenzo Giannini showed up at that point. And then what's happening through the second book, Aquarian Age, and then going into the third one, is he's becoming the kingpin, because the other characters, one by one, start going to him to have regressions into their past lives.
Right.
And then their past lives are part of the story of why they think the way they do at this time. And I think that this is an issue as we go through the change of an age. I think there's a strong tendency for our major past life personalities to come through us very strongly. And if we know something about them and how they're affecting us, it can get to be pretty interesting. So I couldn't resist covering that topic in that way. I'm the author of a trilogy called the Mind Chronicles Trilogy, and it's based on a study of 100 of my past lives. So I did that level of research very deeply 20, 25 years ago, and now I'm having fun playing with it in fiction.
Well, it is true, though, that I was explaining to a nutritionalist today that there are three major causes of illness, and I said, the first one is karma, and she just looks at me, and I was like, what? I go, yeah, the first one's karma. I said, it's usually neuropathic pain and cycles of 7 years, you know, RSD and back pain and headaches and whatever. And I said, there's not too much you can do. So, you know, there's karmic, and then there's attitude, which is emotional and mental, and then there's environmental. And if you don't differentiate those three, in your analysis of a disease, and of course somebody can have all three at once, it is possible, but it's not usual, if you can't analyze and know which is which, then you won't know what you can affect and what you can't. Mm-hmm. Karmic stuff is about the only way you can affect it is through past life regression.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So
that's
it is very important. And many books, I've interviewed the authors of many books, many therapists who use past life regression to get to certain karmic aspects.
It's a very powerful technique. And I don't think you can necessarily prove that that was your past life, personally, even though I've done 100 sessions. But what I do know is the psyche will go right for something in the timeline and into an individual that's going to really give you a huge amount of information about what's going on now. In other words, it's not really about the past. It's about things that are uncovered that we haven't gotten a hold of yet.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we're coming up in the last 5 minutes or so of the interview. Would you like to give your contact information?
My website is handclow2012.com.
Okay.
And we're in the middle, if people go to it, we're in the middle of revising it right now. And I don't know if you've been through that, but oh my God. But it was time, you know what I mean? And so eventually it's going to be just handcloud.com, but it still says handcloud2012.com. And we had to go into all kinds of new outrageous formats because everything's changing so fast, which is another way to get rid of us, those of us who have a lot of information.
Yeah.
You know, because it's so much work to transform your website, but you reach a point where you just have to do it. So that's really the only way that anybody can get through to me is on the website.
So tell us a little bit about when your next book will be out, the third book of the trilogy.
Well, I would think this one just came out now, and it's 2018, and this trilogy is covering 2011 through 2020. So I think it'll come out in 2020. It's going to be either 2020 or 21.
And well, if I'm still doing the radio show, I'd love to interview you on your book.
Okay. Well, another thing, a lot of people, Revelations of the Ruby Crystal is the first novel. And for people who have not read the Ruby Crystal, if they're going to take an interest in the Aquarian Age, they should really start with Ruby Crystal. Because in the first book of a trilogy, that's when we really get to know the characters. We get to know their families and all the fabric and everything. And then once we get into Revelations of the Aquarian Age, as you know, it starts out with the wedding in the first chapter. And all the characters are there, and they're all interacting, but we're not getting as much of their background. So I would suggest to people, if you're taking an interest in what we're talking about here, it's worth it to start out with the first book and then go to the second one.
Okay.
And then the third one.
Yeah, I agree. It did kind of dump you into something and background would have been nice.
So then the third one will come along.
Right.
But imagine trying to write about our times, Susan. Oh, my God. When I first started this, it was somewhat easy to write about our times. Back in 2011, it's not easy now. But I'm going to manage, and I'm going to do it. I made an appointment with Destiny.
Yeah, and, you know, you've got a lot of very interesting things in the book. The information about the true cause of global warming and the energetic changes that we're in the midst of. And, you know, most people just would not get all the connections. And that's what I like about your book, connecting all the different things with, you know, all the energetic changes, with the historical stuff and the religion. The religions probably not being that different from one another, like you said, once you take the untrue parts of the religions out. And it is so important to have a unification occur.
Yeah, we have to stop
without it. We just keep fighting each other and keep poverty and starvation and all the, basically keep everybody in economic servitude.
That's right. Yeah.
Was there any closing statements you'd like to give the audience?
I'll give you a clue about book three. Now, when Donald Trump showed up, I am an astrologer, so I analyzed his chart, and I knew he would win. And I actually won a lot of bets, which I didn't collect on because I didn't want him to win, but he did win. And I think that Donald Trump is playing the role in our current age change of ages to the role of St. Paul 2,000 years ago. Because what happened with St. Paul when he came along was he just started just throwing everything out, just throw out circumcision, throw out the dietary prescriptions in the Torah, whatever. Mm-hmm. And he really reminds me of Donald Trump, where Donald Trump is just throwing stuff left and right and just creating chaos. So that's a little teaser on what I'm working on right now,
okay.
The issue of who is Donald Trump will play a role in the third book. And that's not much fun.
There's no doubt that he is very unique and probably very well suited, both in terms of his spiritual protection and his bloodlines and his his invincibility to having the cabal influence him at all, mm-hmm. which is great.
Yeah.
We just have to assume that everything is perfect all the time, even though that we can't really understand why that is.
Yes,
you know, in the face of things, things would seem much different. And there's a lot of criticism of Donald Trump. But on the very important things, like not being able to be assassinated, that in itself would be terribly important at this time mm-hmm. if you're going up against the cabal.
Mm-hmm. So. Yes. Yes.
So far, he survived, but my inside sources said that there's been a number of assassination attempts against him.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know,
as
you would expect. So.
Yes, I agree.
So he has a great deal of spiritual protection, and that is maybe
and his chart also shows. By the way, his chart also shows that he's the return of a very, very powerful person, of a real major powerful person in the past.
Yeah.
And so I kept watching everybody, trying to figure out who is this? Is Genghis Khan or who is this person?
Right.
I still
yeah.
haven't been able to figure out who,
yeah.
but he certainly is the return of somebody who had a major, powerful past life, and he's back to do some karma.
I agree. I was told when I was in surgery, and I get a lot of stuff in surgery, and I said it out loud. I said, Donald's going to win because the three states will be thrown in his favor, Georgia, Florida, and Pennsylvania, because he's made a deal. And so I can't prove that that's what happened, but I do believe that those three states were important in getting him elected. So
interesting.
Well, anyway, we're coming up on the end of our hour. It's been a delightful interview. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
This is Dr. Susan Kolb. We've been interviewing Barbara Han Clow on Revelations of the Aquarian Age. This is the middle book of a trilogy. And if Barbara will remember us in Temple of Health here and we can get a copy of her book in 2020, hopefully we'll still be doing the show and we can wrap up the story and possibly have more discussions about other things she's going to reveal.
And I will remember you.
Thank you,
Dr. Susan.
Okay. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Please join us next week.